Welcome to The Kinked Wire, the interventional radiology podcast from SIR Publications. You can learn more on our website, sirweb.org/kinkedwire. This episode provides audio abstracts of papers published in the August 2022 issue of SIR's Journal of Vascular and Interventional Radiology. You can find the full papers on jvir.org. My name is Sana Herwald.
Hello. My name is Sahil Patel, and I am a research fellow at Northeast Ohio Medical University. I will be reading the abstract titled, Impact AV Access Randomized Trial, 12-Month Clinical Results Demonstrating the Sustained Treatment Effect of Drug-Coated Balloons, by Holden and colleagues. Purpose: to present the 12-month outcomes of the Impact AV Access Study, a prospective single-blind trial enrolling participants with obstructive de novo or restenotic native upper extremity arteriovenous dialysis fistula lesions treated with a drug-coated balloon or percutaneous transluminal angioplasty, or PTA. Materials and methods. After successful high-pressure PTA, participants at 29 international sites were randomized one-to-one to treatment with an Impact AV drug-coated balloon with a sample size of 170 or standard uncoated PTA with a sample size of 160. Outcomes at 12 months include target lesion primary patency, or TLPP, defined as freedom from clinically driven target lesion revascularization or access circuit thrombosis, access circuit primary patency, number of reinterventions, and adverse events involving the access circuit. Results. At 12 months, TLPP was 63.8% in 90 out of 141 patients in the drug-coated balloon group, compared with 43.6% in 61 out of 141 patients in the PTA group, with a p-value less than 0.001. The total number of reinterventions required to maintain TLPP through 360 days was 93 in the drug-coated balloon group and 144 in the PTA group, with a 35.4% reduction in reinterventions when drug-coated balloons were used. Access circuit thrombosis occurred in 2.9% of the participants in the drug-coated balloon group and 6.2% of those in the PTA group, with a p-value of 0.19. Time to TLPP was assessed using a multivariable analysis to identify the factors associated with loss of patency. The treatment device was the independent predictor with the largest effect, with a hazard ratio of 0.42 and a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions. TLPP was statistically significantly higher with drug-coated balloons than with standard PTA at 12 months, demonstrating the sustained and superior effectiveness of this device for the treatment of dysfunctional arteriovenous dialysis fistula.
Hello, my name is Siddhi Hegde, and I am a graduate researcher at KVG Medical College and Hospital. I will be reading the abstract titled Risk Factors for Hemorrhagic Adverse Events in Percutaneous Transhepatic Biliary Drainage, a prospective multicenter study by Holton and colleagues. Purpose: to determine risk factors for hemorrhagic adverse events associated with percutaneous transhepatic biliary drainage, or PTBD, and to develop a risk assessment model. Materials and methods. This was a multicenter prospective case-controlled study between 2015 and 2020. Adults with an indication for PTBD were included. Patients who had undergone recent previous drainage procedures were excluded. Multiple variables were controlled. The exposure variables were the number of capsular punctures and passes using the same puncture. Multivariate analysis was performed through logistic regression analysis. A total of 304 patients with a mean age of 63 years were included. Hemorrhagic adverse events occurred in 13.5% of the patients, and 3% of the cases were severe. Univariate analysis showed that the following variables were not associated with hemorrhagic adverse events: age, sex, bilirubin and hemoglobin levels, type of pathology, portal hypertension, location of vascular punctures, ascites, non-dilated bile duct, intrahepatic tumors, catheter features, blood pressure, antiplatelet drug use, and tract embolization. Multivariate analysis showed that number of punctures with an odds ratio of 2.5 and a p-value of 0.055, vascular punctures with an odds ratio of 4.1 and a p-value of 0.007, fatty liver or cirrhosis with an odds ratio of 3.7 and a p-value of 0.021, an intrahepatic tumor obstruction with an odds ratio of 2.4 and a p-value of 0.064 were associated with hemorrhagic adverse events. Patients with corrected coagulopathies had fewer hemorrhagic adverse events with an odds ratio of 5.5 and a p-value of 0.026. The predictability was 88.2%. The area under the curve was 0.56. Conclusions. Pre-procedural and intra-procedural risk factors were identified in relation to hemorrhage with PTBD. Adverse event risk assessment information may be valuable for prediction and management of hemorrhagic adverse events.
Hello, my name is Dulcy Taluri, and I am a third-year medical student at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. I will be reading the abstract titled Phase 1 Dose Escalation Study of Tirapazamine Chemoembolization for Unresectable Early and Intermediate Stage Hepatocellular Carcinoma by Chung-Shien Liu and colleagues. Purpose: to investigate the safety of replacing doxorubicin with tirapazamine in conventional transarterial chemoembolization, or TACE, in an Asian population with hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC, and to determine the optimal tirapazamine dose for phase 2 studies. Materials and methods. This was a phase 1, 3+3 dose escalation study for patients with unresectable early and intermediate stage HCC who received 5, 10, or 20 milligrams per meter squared of intra-arterial tirapazamine, followed by ethiodized oil and gelatin sponge-based embolization. Key eligibilities included HCCs no more than 10 centimeters in diameter, prior embolization allowed, Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group performance status of 0 or 1, child Pugh score of 5 to 7, and platelet count of greater than or equal to 60,000 microliters. Dose-limiting toxicity was defined as any grade 3 non-hematological or grade 4 hematological toxicity, with the exception of transient elevation of aminotransferase levels after the procedure. Results. 17 patients were enrolled, 59% of whom had progression from a prior HCC therapy and 35% of whom had progression or recurrence after TACE. All patients tolerated the tirapazamine TACE well without any dose-limiting toxicity or serious adverse events. Using the modified response evaluation criteria in solid tumors, the complete response rate was 47%, and the complete response and partial response rate was 65%. The median duration of response was not reached. The median time to progression was 12.6 months. The median overall survival was 29.3 months. The selected phase 2 dose was set at a fixed dose of 35 milligrams of intra-arterial tirapazamine. Conclusions. Intra-arterial tirapazamine with transarterial embolization was well tolerated and showed promising efficacy signals in intermediate stage HCC, justifying pursuit of a phase 2 study.
Hello, my name is Ali Asnan, and I am a fifth-year medical student at King Edward Medical University. I will be reading the abstract titled Cone-beam CT-guided transarterial tagging of endophytic renal tumors with indocyanin green in patients undergoing robot-assisted partial nephrectomy with near-infrared fluorescence imaging by Nardis and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the safety, efficacy, and clinical impact of preoperative cone beam computed tomography or CT-guided selective embolization of endophytic renal tumors with the fluorescent dye indocyanin green and ethiodized oil in patients undergoing robot-assisted partial nephrectomy or RAPN using near-infrared fluorescence imaging. Materials and methods. Patients with renal endophytic tumors eligible for RAPN and transarterial embolization with indocyanin green and ethiodized oil were prospectively enrolled. Technical success was defined as the completion of the embolization procedure. Radiographic success, defined as ethiodized oil accumulation in the nodule, was classified as poor, moderate, good, or optimal on the basis of post-embolization cone beam CT. Surgical visibility of tumors during RAPN with the use of near-infrared fluorescence imaging was classified as follows. Not visible. Visible with poorly defined margins. And visible with well-defined margins. Results. 41 patients underwent preoperative selective embolization. Technical success was 100%. Ethiodized oil accumulation on cone beam CT was poor in 2, moderate in 6, good in 25, and optimal in 8 of the 41 patients. During RAPN with near-infrared fluorescence imaging, tumors were visible with well-defined margins in 26, visible with blurred margins in 14, and not visible in 1 of the 41 cases. There were no adverse events following endovascular embolization. Conclusions. Preoperative transarterial superselective embolization of endophytic renal tumors with indocyanine green and ethiodized oil in patients undergoing RAPN is safe and effective, allowing accurate intraoperative visualization and resection of endophytic tumors.
Hello, my name is Hamidreza Armani, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at St. George's University School of Medicine. I'll be reading the abstract titled Computed Tomography-Guided Percutaneous Cryoablation in Patients with Lung Nodules Mainly Composed of Ground Glass Opacities by Xupeng Liu and colleagues. Purpose: to assess the safety and efficacy of cryoablation in patients with lung nodules mainly composed of ground glass opacities. Materials and methods. In this retrospective study, 50 patients with a diagnosis of lung ground glass opacity nodules who underwent cryoablation were included. The local recurrence rate, incidence of regional metastasis to lymph nodes, incidence of distant metastasis, adverse events, and lung function condition were analyzed. Results. Follow-up computed tomography, or CT, was performed at a mean of 33 months after the cryoablation procedure. Outcomes were only evaluated in 30 patients. A total of 20 patients were excluded. Of these 20 patients, 10 patients had no cancer detected by histopathological analysis, and a diagnosis was made using CT or positron emission tomography CT or PET CT. The other 10 patients had nodules with a diameter of less than 10 millimeters and a consolidation to tumor ratio of more than 0.25. Thus, histopathological analysis was not performed because of the small nodule size, and patients were diagnosed using CT or PET CT. The local recurrence rate was 0%. Evidence of regional metastasis of lymph nodes was not found in any patients, and the incidence of distant metastasis was 0%. No major adverse events were noted. Lung function recovered to normal within 1 month after cryoablation in all patients. Conclusions. Cryoablation may serve as a safe and feasible option for the treatment of lung nodules mainly composed of ground glass opacities.
Hello, my name is Alexander Ziskin, and I'm a third-year medical student at Eastern Virginia Medical School. I will be reading the abstract titled Drug-eluting embolic chemoembolization for the management of recurrent or advanced head and neck cancer by B and colleagues. Purpose: to characterize the safety, tolerability, and efficacy of chemoembolization using drug-eluting embolic microspheres in patients with recurrent and advanced head and neck cancer. Materials and methods. In this retrospective study, 32 patients with a mean age of 57.2 years with recurrent and advanced head and neck cancer were treated with chemoembolization using drug-eluting embolic microspheres loaded with doxorubicin. Treatment response, overall survival, local progression-free survival, and adverse events were evaluated. Results. At 6 months after the procedure, the objective response and disease control rates were 25% and 69%, respectively. The median overall survival and local progression-free survival were 14.5 and 13.6 months, respectively. 7 or 22% of patients experienced adverse events after the chemoembolization procedure. All the adverse events were related to post-embolization syndrome, including one patient with vomiting and nausea, two patients with pyrexia, and seven patients with localized pain. No severe adverse events or procedure-related deaths were observed. Conclusions. Chemoembolization using drug-eluting embolic microspheres was safe and tolerable in patients with recurrent and advanced head and neck cancer.
Hello, my name is Siddharth Venkatraman, and I'm a third-year medical student at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. I'll be reading the abstract titled Microablation versus Stereotactic Body Radiotherapy for Stage 1 Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, a Cost-Effectiveness Analysis by Wu and colleagues. Purpose. To assess the cost-effectiveness of microwave ablation and stereotactic body radiotherapy for patients with inoperable stage 1 non-small cell lung cancer. Materials and methods. A literature search was performed in the Medline database with broad search clusters. A decision analytic model was constructed over a five-year period. The model incorporated treatment-related complications and long-term recurrence. All clinical parameters were derived from the literature with reference to long-term prospective trials. A healthcare payer's perspective was adopted. Outcomes were measured in quality-adjusted life years extracted from prior studies and U.S. dollars from Medicare reimbursements in prior studies. Base case calculations, probabilistic sensitivity analyses with 10,000 Monte Carlo simulations, and multiple one- and two-way sensitivity analyses were performed. Results. Microwave ablation yielded a health benefit of 2.31 quality-adjusted life years at a cost of $195,331, whereas stereotactic body radiotherapy yielded a health benefit of 2.33 quality-adjusted life years at a cost of $225,271. The incremental cost-effectiveness ratio was $1,480,597 per quality-adjusted life year, indicating that microwave ablation is the more cost-effective strategy. The conclusion remains unchanged in probabilistic sensitivity analyses, with microwave ablation being the optimal cost strategy in 99.84% of simulations. One-way sensitivity analyses revealed that microwave ablation remains cost-effective when its annual recurrence risk is less than 18.4% averaged over 5 years. When the stereotactic body radiotherapy annual recurrence is greater than 1.44% averaged over 5 years, or when microwave ablation is at least $7,500 cheaper than stereotactic body radiotherapy. Conclusions: microwave ablation appears to be more cost-effective than stereotactic body radiotherapy for patients with inoperable stage 1 non-small cell lung cancer.
Hello, my name is Benjamin Miller, and I'm a third-year medical student at Rosalind Franklin University. I will be reading the abstract titled, Pre-Intervention Computed Tomography Improves the Performance of Endovascular Intervention in Patients with Abdominopelvic Trauma by McGraw and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the role of computed tomography, or CT, and CT angiography in guiding endovascular arteriography, or EA, and embolization in hemodynamically stable and unstable patients with abdominal and or pelvic trauma. Materials and methods. A retrospective review was performed of patients with abdominal pelvic trauma who underwent EA with or without embolization from January 2012 to August 2020 at an urban level 1 trauma center. Patients aged under 18 years old or those undergoing EA outside of the abdomen and or pelvis were excluded. Demographics, imaging findings, procedure length, contrast agent administration, laboratory values, and outcomes were compared on the basis of pre-procedural imaging technique and hemodynamic status. Results: a total of 190 patients with abdominopelvic trauma underwent EA with or without embolization. Among them, 123 were hemodynamically stable and underwent CT or CT angiography, whereas 67 were initially hemodynamically unstable and underwent operative management prior to EA. Of these patients, 38 underwent CT or CT angiography after hemodynamic stability was achieved prior to postoperative EA. The incidence of therapeutic embolization for arterial injury on EA was significantly higher in patients with pre-procedural CT or CT angiography with a p-value of 0.04. the positive and negative predictive values of CT angiography for arterial injury at the time of EA were 92.3% and 100% respectively. Prior imaging was associated with a reduced contrast agent requirement at the time of EA and reduced transfusion requirement with p-values of 0.05 and 0.02. No significant differences were observed in adverse outcomes for patients undergoing pre-procedural imaging. Conclusions. CT or CT angiography prior to EA for hemodynamically stable and unstable patients with abdominopelvic trauma may improve the likelihood of therapeutic embolization and enable improved procedure metrics without increasing adverse outcomes.
Hello, my name is Bridget Kowalczyk, and I am a fourth-year medical student at St. Louis University. I will be reading the abstract titled Predictors for Non-Home Patient Discharge Following Lower Extremity Arterial Interventions by Lee and colleagues. Purpose: to identify the variables associated with patient discharge disposition to optimize post-procedural care and discharge planning following lower extremity arterial interventions for peripheral artery disease, or PAD. Materials and methods. The 2014 to 2017 American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program database was queried using current procedural terminology codes for endovascular infrainguinal interventions for PAD. The main outcome variable of interest was non-home discharge. Covariates included patient sociodemographic variables, age quartile with an upper quartile greater than or equal to 77 years, comorbidities such as diabetes, renal disease, bleeding disorder, congestive heart failure, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, presence of an open wound before a procedure, type of procedure, operative time, symptom severity, American Society of Anesthesiologists class, and baseline functional status. Univariate analysis and multivariate logistic regression were performed on Strata Special Edition 15.1. Results. A total of 3,190 patients met the inclusion criteria, of whom 664, or 20.8%, had non-home discharge. Multivariate regression revealed that age with an odds ratio of 1.9 for the upper age quartile greater than or equal to 77 years, operative time with an odds ratio of 1.2 per increase in quartile, preoperative wound with an odds ratio of 1.5, renal failure with an odds ratio of 1.7, congestive heart failure with an odds ratio of 2.2, symptom severity with an odds ratio of 1.7, and independent functional status with an odds ratio of 0.74 were associated with non-home discharge. All p-values were less than or equal to 0.001, unless otherwise stated. Conclusions. Prolonged procedural time, the presence of pre-procedural wound and patient comorbidities, symptomology, and baseline functional status may be used to identify patients who will require a non-home discharge and early discharge planning.
Hello, my name is Michael Harnett, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. I'll be reading the abstract titled Cryoablation of Venous Malformations, a Systematic Review by Fish and colleagues. Purpose: this study aimed to review systematically the efficacy, safety, and technical aspects of cryoablation in treatment of venous malformations and to provide groundwork for future studies. Materials and methods. The literature search for clinical studies utilizing percutaneous cryoablation of venous malformations was performed. All clinical studies related to primary or secondary treatment of venous malformations with percutaneous cryoablation were included in this review. These selected studies were evaluated for patient characteristics, cryoablation technique, technical success, lesion size, and pain scores before and after cryoablation, and adverse outcomes. Random effects analysis of post-procedural changes in lesion volume and pain scores was performed. Results. There were 54 patients with 55 cases of cryoablation of venous malformations. Of these cases, 27 recorded changes in lesion volume and 31 recorded changes in pain scores. The weighted mean post-procedural decrease in lesion size was 92%, with a raw average of 71.7%. The weighted mean reduction in pain score was 77%, with a raw average of 78.2%. Considering all 55 of the treated cases, complete resolution of symptoms was seen in 35 cases, or 63.6%, and overall improvement, including complete or partial resolution, in 52 cases, or 94.5%. Common post-procedural symptoms included pain, bruising, swelling, and numbness lasting less than 2 weeks. There were two major adverse events, equating to 3.7% of the cases, with both cases due to persistent dysesthesia. Patients with history of prior sclerotherapy demonstrated lower pre-procedural and post-procedural pain scores of 4.7 and 1.3 respectively than patients without prior treatments, in whom these pain scores were 5.8 and 2.8 respectively. Conclusions: cryoablation of venous malformations appears to be potentially safe and effective on limited short-term interval follow-up.
We thank all the medical students who helped with this episode. My name is Deepak Iyer. I am a medical student at the George Washington University School of Medicine, currently on a research year at Emory University, and I was your audio editor for this episode. The research from this episode appears in the August 2022 issue of JVIR, and you can visit jvir.org for the full papers, other audio content, and much more.